You're listening to Catch the Current, the coolest seafood podcast out there from the team at Undercurrent News, your trusted source for seafood prices, news, and data. I'm Amanda Buckle.
And I'm Lauren Castiglione. Before we get started, a quick thank you to our sponsor, Wise Fish. For more than 30 years, Wise Fish has helped seafood businesses simplify the way they work. From aquaculture and wild catch to processing and sales, Wise Fish brings everything together in one integrated platform. Find out more at wisefish.com/catchthecurrent.
This week, as promised, we'll be talking about one of my favorite fish, Wadalaska pollock. We've got Undercurrent News Editor-in-Chief Tom Seaman and reporter Jacob Resnick calling in to share some of the highlights and key takeaways from the Association of Genuine Alaska Pollock Producers annual meeting in Seattle, Washington.
So be sure to listen to the end of the episode for that, because we've got some pretty big headlines to cover first, including the latest in the ongoing radioactive shrimp saga.
I wish we had the funds to license music, because every time we talk about this topic, I have that Imagine Dragons song, Radioactive, playing in my head. I'm like rocking out. I'm like, okay, like, yeah, let's cover this. So there were a couple of big developments. Of course, not the developments that shrimp importers were hoping for. This week, Seattle, Washington-based Aquastar issued a recall for 85,000 bags of Indonesian shrimp from BMS due to radiation concerns. That's in addition to the company's recall notice earlier this month for 18,000 bags and a separate notice specifically for Walmart stores for more than 26,000 bags. We've got the specifics on what products were recalled in the show notes, but what really stood out to me was the fact that the notice said that these bags of shrimp were sold in stores between June 12, 2025 and September 17th. The products involved in the latest recall were sold in at least 18 stores in 31 states.
So check those freezers. The recall maintains that no illnesses have been reported to date. The FDA also repeated its August 19th statement, explaining that no product has tested positive or alerted for cesium-137 has entered the U.S. commerce. This update comes as the FDA just revealed on its recently launched food import database that it denied entry for a massive 139 entry lines of shrimp produced by BMS under two codes for adulteration. The denial action took place on September 10th. And remember that the FDA import alert blocking shrimp imports from BMS was issued on August 14th.
So what is happening to all that denied shrimp? Well, it turns out that instead of destroying the shrimp upon discovery of the contamination, the FDA allowed BMS to recover 18 rejected refrigerated containers for potential distribution to other countries. Undercurrent's Jason Huffman reported that because one container can hold as much as 33,000 to 35,000 kilograms of frozen shrimp, that means the total amount of shrimp rejected by the FDA and returned to Indonesia is likely more than 600 metric tons.
Indonesian government authorities have been hard at work to dispel any concerns about the safety of the returned shrimp. According to reports, upon arrival in Indonesia, the containers were inspected by the Indonesian Agriculture Quarantine Agency, the Nuclear Energy Regulatory Agency, the National Research and Innovation Agency, and the Marine Affairs and Fisheries Ministry. The head of the task force in Indonesia investigating the incident said that the shrimp products contain no traces of radioactive material.
I always try to throw in like a mouthful for you to see like where I can just like, you know, set you up. But you did great, Lauren. That was all in one take. That was fantastic.
Thank you. But you usually get me every single time.
So despite the shrimp being denied and removed from the country, and then it testing free and clear of radiation, the Southern Shrimp Alliance, or SSA, a group that represents U.S. domestic shrimp harvesters and processors in the southeastern U.S., still isn't satisfied with the response to the situation. SSA said in a statement to Undercurrent that what has happened to these contaminated radioactive shrimp is shocking. The group said that the FDA sends too many contaminated shipments back to their source countries for potential redistribution, calling it a loophole in our food safety system that allows dangerous products to leave the country and potentially be re-entered at a different point of entry, a practice known as port shopping.
SSA's statement continued that since the FDA tests only 0.4% of imported seafood for contaminants, this creates an intolerable risk that refused products end up back on American dinner plates if not destroyed. And even if the shrimp does not end up back in the United States, the exporter may still sell the shrimp to other markets, reducing incentives to ensure that healthy product is shipped in the first instance.
And in the final recent development regarding the black shrimp, it's no longer the only food item on FDA's import alert for 99.51. So just a reminder that this is a whole new game that the FDA is dealing with. When the government agency first issued the import alert on August 14th, it was the first of its kind. Now all shrimp products from Indonesian company BMS is blocked alongside an Indonesian spice company called Natural Java Spice. So, details on the latest radioactive findings related to natural Java spice are scarce. The company had shipments of spices, including nutmeg, cinnamon, clove, and crushed red pepper, among others, arrive as recently as September 15th at the port of Newark, New Jersey.
However, unlike the recent shrimp import alert, there have not yet been any subsequent FDA recall announcements in relation to radionuclide contamination, at least at the time of us recording this on Thursday afternoon. U.S. Customs and Border Protection has also yet to issue a public statement.
With this new development, I checked back in with Peter Quinter of US law firm Gunster. The law firm previously confirmed to Undercurrent that it was working on behalf of US seafood importers to push the FDA to edit the import alert because only one facility being used by BMS had shrimp contaminated with CS-137. Their argument is that the containers from the other facilities that are not contaminated should be released for entry into the US. But Quinter said that they've had no success yet in getting the FDA to update the import alert.
Speaking of spices, I thought some folks in retail were listening to our podcast and finally made a pumpkin spice fish.
I did too. Our pal and editorial director, Cliff White, he sent over a photo this week of what appeared to be a fresh seafood counter selling a breaded fish item labeled pumpkin spice salmon. When I saw the photo, I thought, we did it, Lauren. We made a difference in the world. We played a part in the creation of something delicious, a new fall staple, pumpkin spice salmon.
But it was a photo from 10 years ago, and we don't even know if it's authentic or just Photoshopped fever dreams someone created, but some girls can hope.
Yeah. I do have to say, though, I didn't think about a pumpkin spice salmon. My thought was always like pumpkin spice pollock.
Didn't you make that the Wi-Fi password at the annual Gap meeting a year
I did. Hashtag
ago?
pumpkin spice pollock. It was a terrible Wi-Fi password. It took ages to type in. It was so long. But I think I told you about this once. We went to Hershey Park. I'm a huge Hershey Park fan. I grew up, my dad was a candy vendor, so I was always around a lot of chocolate. So huge fan of Hershey Park. And when I went there, they have this new restaurant that they have the salmon. The salmon was covered in a crumbled up Heath bar on top. It was phenomenal.
That sounds awesome.
So if you're ever in Hershey Park, but anyway, that made me think of it because it would be like a little bit sweet.
I feel like the flavors would pair really well with salmon, so I'm
Yes.
not opposed to this.
Yeah. So that got me thinking about the pumpkin spice again, but I digress. I digress. So let's get back to the pollock. Let's welcome Tom and Jacob on to get all that hot fish oil on what happened at GAP's annual meeting this year.
But before we do that, a word from our sponsor, Wise Fish.
Running a seafood business means dealing with a lot of moving parts. Farms, catches, production, sales, logistics, each often has its own systems and spreadsheets. Wise Fish brings it all together. Purpose-built for aquaculture and seafood companies, Wise Fish connects biological and financial data so you can see costs, yields, and profitability clearly. The platform tracks feed, treatments, biomass growth, mortality, labor, and equipment costs, then ties it all to harvest and sales planning. Instead of spending time reconciling reports and checking for errors, your team can focus on what matters, making smart, timely decisions that drive growth. Trusted by seafood businesses worldwide, Wise Fish is how the industry moves from guesswork to visibility. Learn more at wisefish.com/catchthecurrent. As promised, joining us now in the pod is Undercurrent co-founder and editor-in-chief Tom Seaman and reporter Jacob Resnick, who were in Seattle, Washington last week for the Association of Genuine Alaska Pollock Producers annual meeting. This was the first time that I missed the event in 3 years. And Jacob, you just blew my mind. You told me that Dutch wasn't there. But the meeting came amid, a slow Alaska pollock bee season, erratic trade policies from US President Donald Trump's administration, and a booming USDA purchase for the US public sector, which we're, waiting on bated breath for. So how did all those factors I just listed play into attendance at the event this year?
Yeah, I mean, other than Dutch not being there and you not being there, I think it was a great event. The according to the PR, spiel on it, the attendance was at a record level, which they said about 280 to 300 people, which I would agree it was a busy room. The mood in the industry is, I would say overall, it's not great. I mean, and maybe that is why there wasn't too much talk at the conference itself on the markets. I would have liked to have seen more of that. Thought it was a good conference. It was informative around the stuff it covered, but there could have been more discussion on what's happening in the global markets for fillets and surimi, the main products that the Alaskan industry that exports. There wasn't really too much discussion on that. But yeah, as you mentioned in the intro there, a big topic really is the fact that bee season has not been great. I was in town before the meeting, got there on Sunday, so I had 3 days of meetings with some people in the industry to kind of get the market read. And yeah, the slow catching in bee season is a big thing. Ron Rognes from Gap, in his excellent presentation, which is very, very data driven, he was saying that he thinks maybe 10 to 20,000 metric tons of fish will be left in the water from bee season, and that's because essentially it's mainly from the processing, the land-based processing sector. The catcher boats are having to go much further to get the fish, and it's just been a poor season fishing-wise. Everybody agreed. These things do happen. I'm not sure it's necessarily reflective of anything with the stock. It's just one of these things. So obviously that, maybe could play into pricing. It's potentially going to be too small a volume to really impact that. The USDA bid, as you mentioned, is a big discussion point in the industry. People say it's going to be anything from 12,000 tons to maybe 15,000 tons maximum of PBO volume, which is, quite large. That's going to come mainly, I think, out of A season and B season for next year, but some volumes from B season this year. Obviously, the issue is a lot of the volume is committed already from B season this year. So I think things will have to be shuffled around with that. And then, obviously, a lot of it's going to come from production next year.
Is there any panic there? Like, how can we fill this?
I don't think so. I mean, obviously, one of the major players in it, Trident, will be, I'm sure, will be involved in the supply, and they control the raw material. So presumably, they can shuffle things around internally. I also think maybe companies had anticipated this. There was volume set aside. What people said to me is this will help clear out any inventory that was left from bee season, like anything unsold. But I think the bulk of it's really going to be next year, from what I understand, for PBO. And then, yeah, the surimi situation is, I was also in town to collect information for these new price assessments we have launched, which is on US PBO every month, Russian PBO, and then Chinese double frozen pollock fillets, which are based on Russian H&G. So we've got those three assessments, which we launched last week. Little plug there. The PBO situation is more positive. The prices are edging up, actually increasing. For spot deals, the prices for PBO is actually going up quite considerably in the past few weeks, which is a positive thing. If you look historically, it's still, not particularly high, given that all the costs for the industry has increased dramatically in, say, the past 10 years. But then if you look at the surimi situation, it's going up again, but, the price has at least bottomed out. And Ron mentioned this in his presentation. It's edging up from a low level because the Russian industry is producing much higher, big quantities of surimi now with the new vessels they've built. And that surimi is going into Asia, predominantly into Japan, China, and these countries, don't really care about the US pollock story. They just want to buy the cheapest product available. In Japan, there is maybe some customers that will be committed to US pollock, and there's obviously some of the big US companies are Japanese owned. The Maruha and the Sui companies in Alaska will obviously, there's a difference there. But the Russians are competing on the surimi in these markets, and it's a new thing for the US industry with that. In China, it's kind of actually developing a new market, which is quite interesting. So that, that market is being developed by the Russians. And actually, some of the US sources were saying, if you look a longer term, what Russia's doing could be quite positive because it's opening up some markets which the US can sell into as well. But in the short term, certainly on surimi, the Russian competition is suppressing the US price. And then on the fillets, yeah, there's some kind of, creeping up on price. And this will kind of lead into what, Jacobin discussed, but the discussion presentation rather from, or speech polemic from Senator Daniel Sullivan was very interesting to watch. He's obviously a sort of firebrand promoter of the Alaskan industry and been very instrumental in these, bans on Russia into the US market, both directly and then for via China. And he also mentioned in his presentation that Canada is very close to a ban on seafood from Russia, which my assumption is that's via China because Canada already banned direct imports, I think, at the same time that the US did. Canada, I think, followed suit and banned direct imports. But what he seemed to be referencing was that Canada was looking to follow the US as example and block Russian seafood, which is processed in China or other third countries and then goes to Canada. This isn't a huge volume trade, but that was interesting. And yeah, I followed up with his staff, but I was told he was moose hunting in Alaska this week. So we're still waiting for a comment on that.
I like how you put that, Dan Sullivan, his polemic. I mean, his
A
speeches,
firebrand.
he hit all the normal points that he does about what he sees as the threats from the Chinese and the Russian fleets on the US pollock industry.
Was he live this year, or was it a recorded
He was
message?
live
No, it was
this
live.
year.
Yeah,
Okay,
live from
awesome.
DC.
Yeah, because he was live last year too, and it does. He hypes up the crowd. He is Alaska Seafood's biggest hype man, and.
No, of course. What he did, you mentioned Dutch not being there. And for listeners who aren't familiar with Dutch, he's the Alaska Pollock mascot. It's a person in a fish costume who runs around with a Seattle Mariners baseball jersey on.
Sometimes
And
a chef's costume.
okay, I've always seen him with this. And this year, I noticed that there really was a pivot in the marketing, and they're steering away from the Seattle geographic associations, even though that's where the fleet is based, and trying to show to an Alaska audience that it's based in the Bering Sea, Gulf of Alaska. It's a very Alaska thing, and that's really important because there's been a lot of political pressure on, especially on the U.S. congressional delegation from Alaska, the two senators and the representative, about concerns about the ecological effects of the trawl industry. And we saw a real strong concerted effort to change the narrative and talk about how it very has strong economic benefits to Alaska as a U.S. state. And Sullivan, one thing that was different about his speech is he took that head on. And I pulled the quote up actually, and he told the industry audience, you really have to work on developing and employing technologies for bycatch reduction. And if you don't take serious actions to address and engage with the public, and then he talks about Alaska stakeholders, he talks about division will continue with regard to the issue. And for me, that means people are calling his office and they are getting emails and they're feeling the political pressure from Alaska voters. And he's up for re-election pretty soon. So that was something different I found from previous GAP meetings.
Well, and you can see that as well in the creation of this Alaska Pollock Fishery Alliance group, which I think was it in 2024 it was created? And there was
Yeah, I
kind of a
believe,
lot
yeah.
of discussion around that and the way the industry is kind of very proactively, as you say, trying to make sure that Alaska understands the benefit to the state from the industry. It's just interesting to me that's only really starting now, that effort. Like, what
Yeah,
you feel
you would
like?
think that actually probably from the whole blog. I mean, you guys did a fantastic job. But the one headline that caught my eye was, yeah, Glacier CEO Johnson, we had to introduce Alaska Pollock to
Yeah.
Alaskans. And that was wild because I thought that, Alaska Pollock, GAP especially has been doing such a great job getting the Pollock name out there. And then to have to let Alaska residents know about the fishery's positive impact on the state is kind of mind-blowing.
Yeah, well, if you remember that like half the population lives at Anchorage, and the way that I don't get too much in the weeds, but the way the economic benefit really filters down is it's going directly to Alaska. It's mostly raw fish tax, which is paid directly to the municipalities where they land the fish. And that's out Dutch Harbor on Alaska and the Aleutians or someplace like Kodiak, way off the road system, way off the rail belt where most Alaskans live. So, people who live in those communities, they very, very much feel and appreciate the economic impact from the pollock industry. But for other Alaskans, they don't really in their everyday life hear about the direct benefits to the US state unless they work in the commercial fishing industry. And if they work in a different part of the fishing industry, like with salmon or halibut, they have concerns about chum bycatch, Chinook bycatch, things like that. And then also you see a lot of the political pressure and the salvos being fired at the pollock industry come from the charter fleet, from the sport guide fishery, which is very politically powerful in Alaska. And they're the ones who make a lot of noise about that. So Alaskans are hearing a narrative from, salmon, from halibut, from charter and commercial sides. And if they don't live in these coastal communities where the pollock has actually landed, they don't really come into daily contact. It's not really on their radar, if that makes sense.
I would presume as well that the companies, mainly, other than coastal villages, is the CDQ Group, they own the Northern Hawk factory trawler. So that's an Alaska company which is operating in the pollock fishery. I guess a lot of the catcher boats would be based in Alaska, but all of the major factory trawlers are all Seattle-based companies. So I presume they're paying tax in Washington State and things like this. And I guess that kind of factors into it all as well, probably. It was
Which is why we're
this
seeing
was
such a
very
concerted
interesting.
effort, right? For this, Alaska Pollock Alliance to really get their own narrative out there, because for too long, I think it wasn't really happening in a big way. And since last year, we were seeing this effort, and it remains to be seen how much it resonates with the Alaska public.
Well, I think the industry generally has always been like, keep the heads down below the radar. And yeah, I mean, and you could see that from the conference in the way that there wasn't really too much talk on the markets. And I would have really liked to see a panel from some senior execs from the big companies talking about the markets in addition to the other stuff. So it's maybe not it's going out of their comfort zone to be doing it, and it is it's good that that is starting to happen. But yeah, it does sound like some it's not like it's too little too late at all, but it sounds like maybe this effort should have started a while back, basically, from what you were saying, Jacob.
And the other thing I wanted to try to touch on is, we had good representation there from the National Marine Fisheries Service, NOAA Fisheries. John Kierlin, who runs the Alaska Regional Office, was there. And the head of NIMS, or acting, what do they call him, the acting secretary, assistant secretary, or Eugenio Soler was there as well. The agency is, I think they're down over a quarter of the staff from the layoffs and downsizing from, the first of the year. And John Kierlin was pretty frank about how diminished capacity for his, agency to do the science-based fishery management. And, we're reading now that there's a, government shutdown looming. There was a reporting this week that there's memos going out to all the federal agencies not to do like furloughs, but if they actually just shut down, do reduction in force, which is actually like firing people, which could make it really a lot more difficult to get the agencies back up to strength when the government, does presumably reopen. So that's something that, as a reporter, I've been going back and forth with NIMS since all week trying to get some more details. But that could definitely be a warning sign for, efforts to manage all kinds of federal fisheries in the US EEZ if that agency is forced to shut down and fire its remaining staff.
So we're gonna let Tom go, but check out the show notes for all the additional coverage and links back to everything that we talked about in the blog, because it's really, standout. So Jacob, I am gonna keep you hostage here for a bit longer because you really made the most out of your trip to Seattle. You also got to meet with U.S. salmon buyer Northline ahead of the activation of its new headed and gutted line. So honestly, I love when you get to go out on location. Those features of yours are my favorite to read. So tell us all about this recent site visit.
Yeah, it was cool. I ran up to Bellingham. It's like a couple hours north by car from Seattle, and they had tied up the barge that I'm sure our readers know all about, this the Hannah, this 400-foot barge that's been in, it's a freezer barge that they were buying whole round sockeye and freezing in Bristol Bay on the Nooshigak.
Oh,
And
Hannah made her name known.
yeah, it caught on fire last year, and they fixed that. And then they had a lot of unpaid vendors, had liens against it. It almost got seized by U.S. Marshals. But long story short, freezer's fixed. Everyone got paid. Liens have been released. So it's, as far as we know, everything's good there. But it brought home a bunch of salmon, sockeye, down. And so now it's tied up on this dock in Fairhaven outside Bellingham. And they used to just send it all to secondary processing for the fillets and things like that. But now they are starting to do their own primary processing, headed and gutted. And they hope to eventually do fillets. But this is, it's one of the scrappy kind of, it's not one of the majors. It's not Trident Seafoods. It's not Silver Bay. But they definitely do have an impact on the market. As we've seen so much consolidation in Alaska salmon. There's a lot of people who work on the fleet who are really cheering them on, hoping to have, because more competition, it's better for the market, for the fleet. But yeah, was down in Bellingham to see that, and sounds like they had a good season, and they actually haven't gotten to flip the switch yet. They're going to start processing in another week or two, but they've been testing it out, and so yeah, it's good to get out of the office.
And since I got you here, one other story that caught my attention this week that you reported on, Alaska fishery managers, okay, experimental Pacific tuna harvest. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I mean, you get warm water goes up to Alaska sometimes, and the tuna follow. And it's happened before, and every so often, anglers will, sport fishermen, and people will like, all of a sudden, wait, I just got albacore. What's going on? So, but there was so many last month that one of the fish and game staff members who works in the sport fish sector went out on a nice day and just caught a ton of albacore. And they thought, there's enough really. They can do a thing where it's called a commissioner's permit, where they put out experimental permit, and they said, like, is there interest? Could we do like a test, can like an experimental commercial one? And so far, I think three boats, it's gonna be like hand trawl or mechanical jig, I've signed up to actually try to do a commercial tuna harvest. Now, the only problem with this whole thing is the weather has not cooperated. Since they put that out, it's just been back-to-back gales. And I actually just pulled up the weather, this morning, and there's actually hurricane force winds are being forecast for Friday. And so, people are tying up their vessels right now and battening down the hatches, literally. They're not out fishing for tuna. So, I talked to the biologist, and she said, she was very frank. She's like, hope they're still there, but once the weather clears, they're gonna go out and see. And it's not clear, who would process them. Some
That
of the
was my
process.
question. I'm like,
Yeah.
these plants aren't set up for that. They're set up
No, they're
for,
not. They're not. But I was thinking a little bit more about it. And since it's such a small little, experimental thing, they could just do direct marketing. They could sell it off the dock. They could probably freeze it. I don't really know that much. I'm showing my ignorance of tuna right now, how it really works. But I think it's enough of a novelty that, if it actually does happen, if they do land, consider, they have good landings this time, and they show up next year, it's the kind of thing that the processors next time around could be ready. So
Wow.
we'll see.
Yeah, that's kind of cool to watch. All right, I won't keep you any longer. We got links back to all of Jacob's recent stories that we just talked about in the show notes. But one last thing is that Jacob, you and I will be reporting from Cartagena, Colombia next week for the Global Seafood Alliance's Responsible Seafood Summit. So it looks like you'll be back on here with me again next week.
Yeah, I just got to find my passport. Kidding.
That's an important thing to have. Yeah, my big thing is that I just had my daughter's sixth birthday and we did a spooky sixth theme. And so
Nice.
the K-pop Demon Hunters is really big in my house. So I had two roomies. And then so I decided to be Mira. So I dyed my hair pink and I thought it was temporary and it is not. So right now, if you see me in Colombia, I could potentially have pink hair. I'm hoping to get rid of it by then.
Right on. That movie's also very big in our household with our kids, so.
All right. Thanks again, Jacob. We'll see you on here next week. As always, we've got some fun news before we go. First, let me just say that I'm not a NASCAR fan. Cars are not really my thing, but I just discovered that there's a race where the prize at the end is a 20-pound live lobster, and now I'm interested.
Oh, me too. I can get on board with that.
Right? Do you like NASCAR? Do you watch?
I don't watch, but I'm not a fan.
Okay. So it's a thing, this live lobster prize. It's been happening since 2008. And this year's winner, Ryan Blaney, said something along the lines of, "I've been wanting to hold that lobster for 30 years." And he said he watched past winners hold the lobster up while he was growing up, and he thought it was the coolest thing ever. And I agree. I think it is also the coolest thing ever. That's got to be like that's a you know there's okay cool you're holding up a trophy somewhere, but to hold up a 20-something-pound live lobster, right? That's got to be.
I'm here for it.
Yeah. It's an unusual trophy, not like the average North American lobster you find in your local restaurant or seafood market. It typically weighs around 20 pounds, like I said. And New Hampshire Motor Speedway reported that 2024's winning lobster clocked in at around 24 pounds. So,
So they get handed this 20-plus pound lobster out on the racetrack, and then what?
and then be grateful that you have a pit crew with you to split
And then immediately everyone gets a
You
leg.
grab a claw. I kid. Some winners eat it. Some in the past have chosen to donate it to an aquarium, but the trophy lobster is traditionally supplied by this lobster and steakhouse in Concord, New Hampshire. The restaurant previously revealed to Bon Appetit that after the cameras snapped those final shots of the winner holding up the lobster, it's then returned to the team there, which pressure cooks it and then removes the meat, and then the meat is flash frozen and sent to the winner.
Very cool.
Yeah, it started in 2008. Someone was just like, "Hey, I got a big lobster. You want it for a prize?" And I'm like, "Okay, why not?"
Heck yeah.
Yeah, trophies are expensive this year. Let's get a live lobster in. I don't know, but that's not all, Lauren.
There's more?
Yeah, actually, I forgot. So wait, this lobster. Okay, enter a taxidermist
Oh gosh.
who then reassembles the broken shell and repaints it to make it look uncooked, and the lobster is mounted, allowing the winner to enjoy it for a lifetime.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, I'm gonna send you the photos. It's pretty impressive. But actually, that's not even the best part of the story.
Okay.
Yeah,
Sorry,
okay. I'm like,
on.
I'm getting there.
All
I'm getting there. I'm getting there. Okay,
right,
so
part three.
NASCAR is using its platform. This is why it's cool. It's using its platform to educate its fan base about sustainably harvested North American lobsters.
There we
Yeah, yep.
go.
It,
This is
it's
what I
it's
was
coming.
waiting
It's here.
for.
So this year, ahead of the anticipated race, NASCAR spent a day on a lobster boat to see how this special lobster gets caught. So it's a
Wow,
near
that's
seven,
awesome.
yeah. It's a nearly 7 minute long video. It shows everything from the bait used and how it's loaded into the traps to how the lobster harvesters know which lobster to keep and which to throw back. It goes over the notching. And then it culminates with the crew pulling up a trap featuring a giant lobster that they hope is big enough to earn its place as the trophy that year.
Well, that gave me a hankering for lobster. I'm sure it will do the same for others.
All right, well, that's it for today's episode. A final word from our sponsor, Wise Fish. From egg to plate, Wise Fish supports seafood business and aquaculture, fisheries, processing, and sales with one integrated platform. Trusted by companies worldwide, including Tassel and Nilspare, Wise Fish helps control costs, improve margins, and make smarter financial decisions. Learn more at wisefish.com/catchthecurrent.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you back here next week.